If someone wishes to join us, they must honor our traditions and prove themselves worthy of wearing the crest of a great house.
Jadzia is worthy.
Of course she is. She's an honorable woman and a formidable warrior.
You should say that to Sorella.
That's not such a good idea. I don't want her to think that I'm interfering in her domain.
Perhaps I should speak with her. Coming from me would not seem like a challenge to her authority.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me to exchange vows.
This is Tyler Orton, using his imagination.
And we're here this week to talk about the DS9 classic episode from Season 6, You Are Cordially Invited.
Cam, is this the funnest hour of Deep Space Nine? You know, I think you've got some other contenders out there like Our Man Bashir or Take Me Out to the Hollow Suite, but You Are Cordially Invited. Everybody has something fun to do in this episode. And even just the line deliveries that we get from Dorn throughout.
I mean,
like Worf as kind of the comedic kind of fall guy is always kind of easy, but he's genuinely funny in this, in more of that kind of the self-aware way. And we talked about the journey of Worf a couple months ago. I don't think Michael Dorn gets enough credit for just what he brings to the role, especially when he gets so much to do in an episode like this. I'll get into some of the Jadzia stuff in a little bit. What's your broader takeaway from a classic episode of Deep Space Nine like You Are Cordially Invited?
It's an episode that is like so light and frothy and makes it all look so easy. And I think of how many Star Trek episodes there are that try to create these kind of light comedy episodes, you know, very like ensemble, character-driven, light episodes. And a lot of them feel like you can hear the gears turning against each other as they're trying to pull this off, and it feels kind of leaden. Whereas this episode is just such a joy from beginning to end. And it also, you know, you were saying, is it the most fun? And I immediately did think, you know, Take Me Out to the Hollow Suite, but I think this is maybe the best one for real character insight, because not only is it very funny and very insightful, but like we just get to learn so much about Worf, but also about Jadzia, their dynamic, and one of the all-time great Sisko and Jadzia heart-to-hearts. Like this episode kind of has it all.
Well, even just little moments like when Jadzia's lighting the Varhama candles and Worf asks if they're real. And she was like, yes, Worf, I ascended up this giant mountain. I had the blood sacrifice there, melted down the shoulder blades of the Targ and Tatalo, had Quark mold these and blah, blah, blah. And then like Worf was like, I was just asking, you know, just like fun stuff like that, that kind of really showcases where both characters land best, both in this relationship, but also just kind of their quintessential character traits too. And I don't know, I will say this though, I don't think Jadzia comes off particularly well in this episode. I think it might be my least favorite version of Jadzia, where she's just very dismissive of, you know, Klingon ritual, which is seriously weird, because like Curzon knows all about Klingon ritual. He knows how to schmooze with Klingons, and she seemed like just so dismissive of what she was trying to do with Sorella in order to be accepted into the House of Martok. She even goes so far as to tell Sorella, like, oh yeah, your grandma was a concubine? Like, what on earth is she thinking with this? You know, I don't think Jadzia comes off great in this one. I don't know. What's your take on Jadzia's broader storyline?
What is funny that when it comes to like a blood oath and possibly dying, taking down the albino Klingon, she's all on board, but have to suck it up and deal with basically the equivalent of like a tough mother-in-law. And she's like, the hell with this. I'm out.
It's very strange.
It's, uh, It is a very strange choice. I guess, like, they kind of get to the core of it where Curzon feels a certain almost like entitlement because of all of the memories of playing such a significant role within the Klingons that she feels like this is beneath her to have to prove herself again. So I can understand where they're going with the character there, and having someone who's kind of feisty and young, like a Jadzia, mixing with like Curzon's sense of knowledge of the Klingons. I can understand from a character point of view, but it does kind of like take some of the fun out of the Jadzia storyline, because there's definitely points where you're like, oh, like this is, I can understand Worf's kind of disapproval or hurt feelings about this. And usually Worf is the one that we go, he's in the wrong.
Yeah, always the obtuse one he is. But I'm a little kind of surprised that they never brought Sirella back for any reason. Like, she gets a lot of shout outs through the remainder of Deep Space Nine's run. But I thought she landed well. And she's just kind of this amazing yin to like Martok's yang. And I was like, come on, like they could have found a way to bring her back at some points. I mean, you could make the argument like, well, you know, the Dominion War made things more difficult for her to visit the station. But I mean, come on, you could have figured something out.
Yeah, I just don't understand that, because it's such like a home run character. And I know like Ronald D. Moore said like he felt like he'd kind of failed the Klingons earlier by not establishing the importance of women within their society, and that this character was very much an attempt to kind of answer for that, you know, falling short in the past. And I'm like, Sirella is such a dynamic character. I think Shannon Cochran just plays it to the hilt. And I love that the character is, on one hand, yes, like very imposing, very demanding, but there's a twinkle in her eye as well. Like that moment at the end when they're at the altar, like you can see that she's very like approving at the end of the day. Like she's someone who is tough up front, but I kind of think she's also secretly rooting for Jadzia. And the fact is, Jadzia is the one that gives up on herself versus Sirella actually, you know, kicking her out.
Well, why did Sirella agree to the wedding by the end of the episode, though?
Well, I mean, they kind of have that off screen, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, she has to go and beg for forgiveness. Would have liked that scene. That would have been quite the scene, I think, to see.
Yeah. It is interesting, though. You know, I do wonder, I'm trying to make sense of the character a little bit, because obviously she believes mm-hmm. she has some sort of imperial blood. She's obviously from some sort of high Klingon house. Why did she marry Martok all those years ago? You know, Martok was kind of lowborn. He wasn't even accepted into the Klingon Imperial Army. He was like a cook at first, and he had to work his way up. Why would Sirella want to be with this kind of a jolly Viking-esque sort of warrior?
Well, they do, you know, highlight in this episode, you can't really choose who you fall in love with. I guess there was just something about Martok where, it's like there was just something about Gowron that won her over at the end of the day. I mean, honestly.
Wow, Gowron. I had no idea she was so interested in Gowron.
Yeah, I totally corrected myself there. Sorry, Martok. What am I talking about? yes, I didn't sleep last night very much, folks. I apologize. But
you were at a Klingon bachelor party with.
That's why.
There's too much debauchery going on there.
Yeah, like, I am not someone who's like, please give me the prequel stories to Star Trek, but I would be curious to see the prequel story of how those two kids got together, because I think it would be pretty entertaining.
I'm sure that they could do some sort of animated short trek, very short trek, in which we get a Martok Sirella hookup or something like that. It is, I don't know, but I do like the words of wisdom that Martok was able to share with Worf, you know, like how it is opposites attract in both cases of Worf and Jadzia, as well as Martok and Sirella. And I think this would have been like one of Martok's like best episodes, you know, everything from him being promoted to Supreme Commander of the Ninth Fleet and how he doesn't want to deal with all that paperwork, to him just being able to be there for Worf when he needs it most. You know, it wasn't like Worf went to Ben to fix things. Obviously, like, I think it would have been a little silly if Ben was fixing things for both people getting married. But I don't know. I think this is like one of Martok's like best episodes. Definitely kind of up there with maybe Soldiers of the Empire too.
Well, it's an episode where he gets to be very funny, but also like get across that wisdom that he has. And like Martok is often kind of just like the badass Klingon we get to see in command on a ship and what have you. And where you're like, this guy is the best. This is like one of the episodes where you really get to see the humanity, for lack of a better word, of the character. And he's just like, you understand him. Like, often I think Klingons can come across a little one-dimensional on Star Trek. You know, you kind of get the Viking warrior going into battle, you know, honor, all that sort of stuff. And the fact that, like, we get to kind of see the emotional side of Martok and to have that moment later on where he talks about, like, what good is, you know, victory and honor if you don't have someone to share it with. And that's not something you would see a lot of Klingons say on a different Star Trek episode or show.
And it's interesting in like kind of the diversity of the Klingons showcase just in this episode, where you have as Worf, or as Quark calls Worf, you know, the walking frown. You have Martok, who is very much that jolly warrior. Mm-hmm. And then you have Alexander, who's just like a total goof. And, you know, there was an interesting exchange, though, when like the plan was, OK, they're after the Klingon War, or after the Dominion War ends. The plan was that Jadzia and Worf would get married on Kronos, but then Alexander is being transferred off the Rotaran onto this battle cruiser, and Jadzia says, well, why don't we, you know, get married so that Alexander can be here for that? Well, presumably he'd be invited to the wedding on Kronos as well after the war. I think Jadzia must have thought that, like, Alexander is going to get himself killed, like, more easily in the Dominion War than any other outcome that would happen to him.
I had that thought as well.
Yeah.
Because he mentions transferring to that different ship, and they have a like visible reaction on their faces when he says he's going to go to that ship. And I'm like, what, is this like the Death Ship or something? Like, they seem to really know more than he knows. And we never really heard that much from Alexander after this episode.
No, no.
I had totally forgotten that the impetus for like the wedding happening in this episode was Alexander. I completely blanked on that. And when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh my God, I totally forgot that Alexander was such a pivotal part of this entire journey.
It was just interesting because I think this is the last time we ever see Alexander on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Which is a little, I don't know, like I kind of liked what they were doing with this iteration of Alexander. You know, like he is kind of the goofball. And not exactly what Worf imagined. You and I had discussions about this with Worf's arc on season 3 of Picard. I just kind of wish they addressed Alexander, or even just gave him like, had Worf say something about his son. I don't know how exactly that relationship has evolved over the years. Because remember, we did see that, I think the episode was Firstborn, in the very end of TNG,
yeah.
In which you have Alexander from the future come back in time to, I don't know, help fix some wrongs. And I'm just like, so that's, I don't know, that's the closest we have to like an adult version of Alexander. It's just kind of weird. Like, it seems like a character that, I don't know, he's been around the Star Trek universe for so long, but he doesn't seem as if he's kind of reached the peak of his arc, even for kind of like a minor character like him.
Well, it feels like he's almost underused in this episode as well. Yes, he's going on like the Klingon bachelor party events and what have you, but like I felt he kind of vanished by the end of the episode, and it would have been nice to have maybe a moment between Worf and Alexander, because he is kind of standing in as like the best man. Like, just have some little moment, and I know they're probably packing a lot of story into this 45 minutes, so things are going to hit the floor along the way, but if this is the final moment we see of Alexander on screen, I would have liked something, especially apparently as Worf, that's all he talks about is Alexander. He's single-minded in talking about Alexander. That's not something I ever got from the show, nope. But hey, I'll take their word for it.
Yeah, it's interesting here. Okay, you bring up, you know, he's the best man, the sword bearer. We also see that, you know, Julian and Miles, Ben and Martok, they're all part of the kind of the Klingon bachelor party. You jump forward to Picard season three, and Worf is describing Odo as one of his great friends, you know, from way back when. Mm. Odo was not invited to the bachelor party, though. Would Odo have even said yes?
No.
More like
everyone's
no-do.
Everyone's going. Is like Kira there to like nudge him in the ribs to be like, you better go?
No, because they were fighting. They were fighting at this.
I know.
In this episode, so.
Yeah, I don't think so. Like, I think he would probably find a way to get out of it to, you know, he has duties to perform on the station.
Yep.
So I think he would probably try to not go. But part of me wonders if he would be roped in by, like, Bashir and O'Brien and Sisko.
I think the real thing is he and Worf are not friends. They just aren't friends, which is totally fine. They're coworkers. You don't have to be friends with everybody. You know, I just thought it felt a little phony when Worf was describing him as a good friend in Picard season three. It's just not true.
Well, Tyler, I don't know if you remember, but Odo was all Worf talked about through season seven, DS9. And he was single-minded in his fixation on Odo.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. There's other fun things to quibble about. You know, like Keiko clearly was not invited to the wedding or to Jadzia's stegettes. What do you make? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can kind of headcanon it, but what do you make of O'Brien being the only representative of TNG who made it to the wedding?
Well, I would suspect that that has to do with paychecks, and they don't want to pay for a TNG cast member to come over. But it's so weird not to have even just like an offhand mention. Oh, you know, Riker's busy during the Dominion War. He can't make it or something. Because you would think someone would be there, right? Like, it's just so weird that Worf wouldn't have communicated with anyone from the TNG crew to invite them. They're not going to get Patrick Stewart to show up, but really, they wouldn't have been able to just, I don't know, get LeVar Burton to swing by for an episode or something?
Even background actors like Tracy Cuoco could have, like, made an appearance and would not have cost them an arm and leg.
Argyle, what's that guy up to?
Yeah.
Like, get him in there.
Yeah. You know what? Max Groeneschek, he played a background actor in Star Trek Insurrection, and I think his scene was cut. Mm. I think you can just take Max Groeneschek out of that ROM makeup and put him in the background there. Pretend as if he was like a long-running like background player on the TNG Enterprise.
Right. And then also, the actress who played Cyrilla played one of the Bajorans who teamed up with Riker, Thomas Riker, in Defiant, but she was also in Preemptive Strike. So I guess that kind of counts as well.
I don't think it counts, Cam. I really don't.
Oh, well, I tried.
Who do you think, out of all the characters, not the actors, but who out of all the characters, who do you think would have been most likely to show up at Worf's wedding?
I think it's Riker and Troy.
Yeah?
I think so, yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, who else? Like, because obviously, like, the Dominion War is going on, but they really didn't seem as if the Enterprise was doing much during the Dominion War. They were searching for the Fountain of Youth at one point. You know?
Seems very self-serving.
Yeah.
They're like, everyone else is at war and dying, and they're like, we're going to go search for that Fountain of Youth.
Yeah, yeah. So, the thing is, like, I don't think you could have just gotten, like Riker and Troy to get, like, a weekend pass to go to Worf's wedding. I think you would have had to bring the Enterprise to Deep Space Nine, and the entire cast would have had to be there. And I, as you said before, Cam, the paychecks and the practicality of that, it would have been a little too much.
Well, you even had like the dancer who, you know, was performing at Jadzia's party and references that the ship he serves on is overseen by Captain Shelby. Even Shelby wouldn't swing by for this one.
Do you blame her, though?
No, I don't think she was that close to Worf after the events of Best of Both Worlds.
I don't think they kept in touch afterwards.
Yeah, she ghosted him.
I do want to shout out like how this episode kind of fits into the broader arc, though. You know, they are acknowledging like they've been back on the station for a week. We even get kind of the Deep Space Nine theme playing as Ben walks on to Ops for the first time in this episode, mm-hmm. at least. We have Ben saying, you know, it's good to be home. And I also think back to the episode, Kira said, do you know how much I hated having to say good morning to Dukat every day? But there was that episode in the Dominion War occupation arc. I'm forgetting which one exactly, but it was when Kira realized that she had become complacent with Dukat's presence. And yeah. She was just kind of going through her regular routine as if, we're just operating a space station again. And that's what kind of inspired her to get involved with some sort of like underground movement. I don't know. It's just kind of interesting how they're touching upon this. And I think that they really did have to deal with Kira's feelings about Odo following him kind of falling under the spell of the female changeling. Although I don't know how I described it is quite accurate. I think Odo is completely genuine about him wanting to be with his people. And he was preoccupied with the female changeling through his own volition. She didn't cast a spell on him or anything like that. And I think that genuinely hurt Kira.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this episode kind of deals with that in a kind of playful way. And in a way that probably doesn't make that much sense if you just popped into this episode randomly.
Sure. Yeah.
Because there's no exposition about it whatsoever, really. And the fact you have those two amazing GIF-worthy moments of Odo dodging Kira in the hallways. And then just them talking off screen. It's nice to see the two characters connect. But yeah, it doesn't really kind of delve into what had actually happened. And I wonder if it's just because this is a light, kind of fun episode. And to suddenly have Odo having serious discussions about his relationship with the female changeling over the course of those events, that kind of weighs down the fun.
I'm kind of okay with them having that conversation in the closet, as they did in this one. It might be a little cheap, but I kind of think we kind of already know as an audience what would have been said, because it would have just been restacking all this exposition that we would have watched in the preceding six episodes. We already knew how these characters felt. We knew what the actions were of these characters. We knew eventually that they would become friends again. So I think it's actually kind of smart if do we really want to make the audiences kind of sit there and go over everything we already knew?
It's not a one-to-one comparison, but this is kind of a breather episode like Family was from TNG just after Best of Both Worlds, where that story, it's all about Picard's relationship with his brother Rene, and that's the conflict of the episode. And yes, we get over the course of that the events of Best of Both Worlds really had a massive impact on Picard, but that's not what the story's about. And I think that this episode kind of, in a way, follows a similar track where it's about the wedding of Jadzia, and what's happening with Odo and Kira is touched upon, but it is no way is something that informs the story.
Yeah. Do you think Rom and Lita are upset that they didn't get an entire episode devoted to their wedding?
Neither did O'Brien and Keiko, really. I guess in some ways they get a little more of a showcase, but not a huge showcase. That's more of a Data story, really. I would have to imagine there's at least a few actors on Star Trek who look at this episode and are like, wait, why didn't I get more of a centerpiece for my wedding on the show?
Well, same with Ben and Cassidy. That wasn't really much of a wedding. It was, I think it was just one shot of Admiral, what's his face, marrying them.
Yeah. And also, I'd have to imagine a lot of actors would be very jealous of Terry Farrell, who gets this iconic Klingon wedding dress that she walks out in, that looks, incredible. And that image sticks in the fabric of Star Trek forever. And there are other weddings on Star Trek. And how many images actually lock into your mind from them?
I'm trying to think. I guess I kind of remember O'Brien and Keiko's, because I think Keiko is wearing traditional Japanese garb. Mm-hmm. But what else? I don't know, man. What about Tom and B'Elanna?
I don't remember a whole lot about that one.
Nor do I. I remember more from the episode in which their doubles. Was that Demon? Or no, that was Course Oblivion.
Yes,
I remember
that's right.
More of their Course Oblivion doubles wedding than I do from whatever nuptials the actual versions of those characters exchanged.
I remember more of those doomed crew members who get married at the start of Balance of Terror
right.
than I do of the Tom and B'Elanna wedding at the moment.
Yeah. Was it even on screen?
It must have been, right?
Why can't I remember this? Like, I
have vague memories that it sort of happens in the, it's not on one of the holodeck programs, but I remember the scene with the other characters. Did the episode open with just everyone kind of like applauding as they had just gotten married or something?
I have no idea. I'm now going to go Google Tom Paris and B'Elanna Torres' wedding just to see if an image comes up.
A true iconic moment in Star Trek, clearly.
So it looks at, okay, so they're on the Delta Flyer sipping champagne. It looks as if they're on like kind of a honeymoon when I'm looking at Google images.
Okay.
Okay. So this is the episode Drive, season 7, episode 3.
Right.
And he enters the Delta Flyer into a space race, and they get married at the end.
I remember the episode quite well, because Saya Batten, a friend of Subspace Transmissions, appeared on that episode. But all I think about really is the Course Oblivion wedding. It's almost like I think because they had shown at least that the end of that wedding that you couldn't kind of do it again, so they sped past it in Drive.
I like that pun there. Thank you. Unintentional Thank you. On your part.
Or was it?
It's just weird that, okay, their wedding episode is dedicated to Tom in a race. It's like, it's not an equal partnership here.
No. And yeah, it's very much, yeah, that story's all about him. Why didn't they do more of a wedding episode for Tom and B'Elanna? Was it because the DS9 one was so like big and memorable they didn't want to try to compete with it?
Yeah, that might be. But I mean, I don't know. Yeah, they must have been aware of that. Like, I know that they kept the writers' rooms pretty separate back in the day, but they must have been aware of like what a big deal they made out of the Worf and Jadzia wedding. So here's maybe what explains our dumbfoundedness. Based on the Wikipedia description of the episode, they got married off screen. They dumped this damaged warp core, and then the next mission of the Delta Flyer is shown to be Tom and B'Elanna's honeymoon. So it pretty much, yeah, like that. This is weird, man.
I wonder if it was just like, we've seen weddings on Star Trek before, let's just skip past it. I guess like they could focus more on like the birth of their child, which was something that was less focused on in Star Trek in the past. So was it really? They'd done it a couple times because you had Kira carrying O'Brien's child, and that was like a whole plot point. I don't know. It did feel like Tom and B'Elanna were shortchanged, but I also just wonder how much of that is the show also wanting to focus more on Janeway, Seven, and the Doctor.
Yeah. But I still think it's weird that the episode in which they get married, it's dedicated mostly to Tom. It's more of a Tom episode than a Torres episode.
And like a ship race.
Yeah.
It's not even related to marriage or love or anything like that.
Or any of her hobbies, like extreme sports.
It kind of does tie into her hobbies, though, I suppose. Like, the two of them should have bonded over this race. Like, you can definitely have a high-speed race and have that tie into B'Elanna's love of thrill-seeking.
True. And engineering.
It's a perfect episode. Why was this not a iconic marriage episode for the ages?
Okay, so for ranking marriage episodes, would we agree that Cordially Invited is at the top of the list?
That's at the top. Is the name of the Keiko and Miles one Data's Day? Is that it?
I think so. Yeah. I would say that's number two.
Yeah.
Okay. Like Drive number three?
Yeah. Or do we put that below the Course Oblivion one with fake Tom and B'Elanna?
Yeah. Let's do Course Oblivion number three.
Yeah.
Okay. Where does Nemesis rank?
Oh, he is singing Blue Skies, and people do remember that. Oh, is that is that the second most memorable wedding? I think that might be, if you ask people, the second most memorable.
Yeah, but that's mostly because of Data, not because of Riker and Troy.
And actually, the actress who plays Cirilla is in the movie Nemesis. Is she the, like, magic touch that really brings these wedding episodes to life?
Wow. I think we found the constant thread.
Yeah. If you want a successful Star Trek wedding, you got to hire that actress, Shannon Cochran.
Okay. I don't know. To me, I say that we could put this as... Okay. I'm gonna put you on the spot. Take me out to the Holosuite, or you are cordially invited. What's the funnest episode of Deep Space Nine?
I would say Take Me Out to the Holosuite is the one that I would say is the more fun one. But it's like, I'm like trying to decide between like a episode and an A- episode, kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, in this one, Jadzia acts like a jerk. And in Take Me Out to the Holosuite, Ben acts like a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Who's a bigger jerk in their respective episodes?
I think Ben. I think so.
Okay.
Like, I can understand Jadzia's anger towards, you know, Cirilla. Like, I can understand how these two very strong personalities would butt heads. And I don't necessarily, you know, love the way Jadzia acts in the episode, but, like, I can understand it. Whereas, like, when you're, like, picking on Rom, that just feels, like, mean-spirited.
It really does. Okay, ultimately, I'll give it to Holosuite as the funnest episode. But I will say that... I think everybody got a lot more to do. Holosuite is mostly focused on Ben and Jake, I'd say.
Yeah, I agree.
And Roman Greco wrestling that apparently he did with that Vulcan back in the Academy days.
Which episode is funnier, do you think?
I have to say, you know, Worf saying death to the opposition on the baseball field, that was pretty darn good.
I know, that's what pops to my mind as well. This one, it's like, it has multiple really funny moments, but they're almost like, I don't want to say they're less memorable, but they're just like, they're less, like, big. Like, that Worf death to the opposition, everyone remembers that who saw that episode. Yeah. Whereas, like, here, when I was watching this episode today, it's like that, even that moment where they're going through the various trials, and, like, the trials are always funny during the bachelor party, but the moment where they're going to do, like, bloodletting, and, like, Sisko pulls back O'Brien and Alexander so that Bashir has to go first. Like, that's such a, like, subtle little moment of humor, but it's so funny. And there's, like, several of those strewn throughout.
Yeah. I did feel bad for those guys in terms of they're about to dig into their steaks and linguine. Then the wedding was back on.
Sisko was pretty gung-ho on continuing with this 4-day torture fest.
I don't know if I would have been nearly the right one to invite to a Klingon bachelor party.
I mean, it looks beyond miserable.
Yeah.
I would have definitely been like pulling the "I'm a human" card. I can't do this heat. This is like going to kill me. I'm sorry.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, they were understanding.
Okay.
I was going to ask another question. Because we were talking about TNG cast members, should they have come to this wedding? Should they have had Worf's adopted parents show up?
Yeah, and the guy from Law and Order as well. What's his face? Paul.
The guy from Law and Order.
Paul
Sorvino?
Sorvino, yeah.
Was he on Law and Order?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a detective for at least one season, like early on. But, you know, Paul Sorvino, he's on that... very primitive planet with his bride and child. He could take, you know, pretend he's off in the mountains for a week all on his own and go visit his brother.
If this episode were being made, I don't know, in Picard season 3, obviously we have to dance around a lot of various events because Jadzia has obviously passed on, but like, do you think there would have been more of an effort to cram the screen with recognizable faces at that wedding just because of the way that storytelling is done now where they want so much connectivity between past events and characters and all that sort of thing versus, you know, the 90s?
Like, I know what you're saying, but I just, all the interviews I heard with Terry Metalis, the showrunner for season 3 of Picard, was that they tried to bring other folks back and they just kept looking at the budgets. And so it was a lot of it, you just had to kind of kill your darlings. And I think that this would have been kind of a budgetary issue as well, even for a show that had such a much, like a much, much bigger budget than You Are Cordially Invited.
Yeah. And I was going to also ask, do you think we will ever have Alexander play any sort of, like, I don't know, element in a story going forward?
I mean, if we do, the most likely thing is Lower Decks. You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't really know what you do with the character without Worf being involved and it having any sort of meaning. And I just don't know. I don't know, man. Like, if you look at the state of Paramount right now, in which it appears as if...
Oh, great.
Well, it's bad, people, for those not following, like, the entertainment industry news. It looks as if there might have to be kind of a fire sale going on, but one that doesn't necessarily involve the Paramount Plus streamer. And I don't know what that means for the future of Star Trek, but it doesn't mean good things. So I just don't know if we're going to get a ton of, you know, Star Trek adventures in which Worf could be incorporated, and then Alexander fits into that as well.
So you're saying Star Trek Legacy might be delayed maybe 6 months?
sure. Only 6 months. It's not going to happen, people. It's just not.
No, I think if we were going to have any sort of, like, resolution to where Alexander wound up, it would have had to have been on, like, that Captain Worf spinoff that Michael Dorn was trying to push for a long time. It is kind of a bummer because, you know, when you go to, like, season 3 and even season 2 of Picard, they're trying to give resolution to, you know, Wesley showing up and then obviously all the TNG crew in season 3. I think in a previous episode we talked about other characters who haven't gotten resolution, and all we really mentioned was Sela, but Alexander is the other one that kind of lingers.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, look, fun episode. I think this is kind of an under-the-radar, kind of solid ensemble episode as well, in that they give everybody something to do at the very least, and a lot of it goes deeper. I think kind of like the Kira Odo stuff, not tons of screen time, but I thought that it was very meaningful screen time that they did get. And even somebody like Martok, who's not a regular, he's showcased quite well. So yeah, you are cordially invited. This is one of the best Deep Space Nine episodes out there, I'd say.
Also, a classic Nog dance that has lived on.
So much so that this is your Ernest dance when you hit the clubs, dressed as one of the Roxbury brothers.
That's my go-to. Okay, so why don't we pivot over to an event that we didn't really see coming when we recorded last week, Tyler. You and I went and attended the opening weekend premiere of the new William Shatner documentary, You Can Call Me Bill, at our local theater. This popped up, and I didn't realize it was opening, and we were like, well, we should probably talk about this on the podcast. And it was an experience, am I right?
Yeah, it wasn't like... Well, okay, so we can talk about the film itself, but maybe I'm guessing you want to start with, like, the in-theater experience that we had?
Yeah, I think that's a nice setup, and I think speaks to the movie's smashing success at the box office this weekend.
Well, you and I, we buy the tickets, and in the afternoon, we noticed that there was only one other seat that had been sold by that afternoon. You arrive before I do. I walk in, and it's completely empty, save for you. That one seat that had been sold earlier in the afternoon, that fella eventually came in. And then a second person came in, and he was having a lot of struggles with the ticketing agent. In kind of that hallway that leads from, like, kind of the entrance exit of the theater into the seats, you know what I'm talking about, audience members. Ticketing agents don't stand there. They stand at the entrance of the actual theater. And so I don't know what was going on, but he was kind of having an argument. It was disruptive. He eventually comes into the theater, sits behind the other fella that had purchased a ticket, and then he starts talking to himself for a bit. And then that other ticket guy, ticket purchaser, I should say, how long do you think it took until he just got up and left?
It wasn't very long, maybe like 5 minutes.
Yeah. And so then that man who's talking to himself, he got up and moved closer to the screen and continued to talk to himself. He eventually left, and then another person came in, and he took a phone call. and I just remember him, like, you only hear one side of the conversation, but I remember him picking up the phone and him going, "Nothing much." Like,
and he got nothing going on.
Yeah. And so then he eventually, like, moves into that kind of that hallway area between kind of the auditorium and the entrance into the auditorium. And then he proceeds to talk some more and more until the point that I had to get up and I was like, dude, like, we can hear you. We're just trying to watch the movie. He moves ever so slightly towards the exit. And then I was like, no, dude, seriously, I think you heard my voice like kind of elevate a little bit more that second time. And he finally like made his way to the exit. And then we also witnessed a couple walk in, you know, like a man and woman and full, you know, fresh bag of popcorn in hand. And they were clearly having a debate as well. I think the guy wanted to sit there and watch it. And the woman was insisting no. And they did not even sit down. They eventually just left. I think you and I counted, what, including like maybe one of the ticketing agents, I think like a total of like 8 people walked in and eventually left before the movie ended. We were the only ones to sit through the entire film.
And many of those people walked in like a third into the film, halfway through the film. It was a fascinating experience. And, you know, you and I went and saw For the Love of Spock, the Leonard Nimoy documentary, a couple, you know, few years ago now. And it was also a very sparse crowd. But this one, I think, really raised the bar. And the whole, you know, experience was so disruptive and chaotic. It reminded me a little bit of when you and I were up against Patrick Stewart in Las Vegas and that panel there.
Yeah. So let me say this. I understand why people got up and left during our screening. This is not a very good documentary. Like, I think you and I were entertained. There's a lot of wild clips across Bill Shatner's career.
Yep.
I think that's what entertained us. But this is an incredibly disjointed documentary. There's absolutely no narrative or no storyline whatsoever. It's just Bill Shatner. He's literally the only talking head, the only one that they interviewed for this. And it's him just kind of spouting a lot of that galaxy brain BS that you and I have heard from him many times at many conventions where we've been bored out of our minds. The only thing I walked away with is that he loves to perform. He likes performing comedy, and he's very, very concerned about climate change. I just like this was like a slog. I mean, if not for these clips, and I think you and I were amazed by how many clips were licensed for this film.
Yeah.
If not for those clips, I think you and I may have gotten out and like walked out of the theater as well. If it was just like having us like forcing us to listen to like this nonstop William Shatner, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's just nothing there. Like, nothing of substance was shared with us watching this film. My personal take, anyway.
I mean, I'm not too far off. I mean, we definitely laughed at a lot of the clip usage. But also, there was just some moments of, I don't know how self-aware William Shatner was when he was saying something. And you and I definitely cracked up a number of times over the course of the film just for those kinds of reasons. But the thing I realized at a certain point was, I know this was, I think they used like 2 or 3 sit-down recordings of Shatner for this documentary and pieced it together. And I became very aware at a certain point that they could have sat down with William Shatner 4 days later for another 3 days, and they would have had a completely different, philosophical journey as this one. It's just like clear that he likes to basically just spout stuff off the top of his head, and he has various topics he's interested in, but they kind of blur all over the place because we've seen this man many times over the years, and we always will kind of pinpoint his obsessions. You know, 1 year it's pixels, 1 year it's termites. You know, we'll hear a lot about horses, and they always kind of change, but the kind of overall sense of William Shatner kind of pontificating in a way that really isn't that insightful. It's more like someone who is very, in some ways, articulate and very verbose, that kind of tricks people into thinking he is, I don't know, underlining some deep human truth or world truth, that it's like, oh, he's onto something, when I don't really think that's the case at all.
No.
And it just feels like kind of the hot air bag kind of on screen. And they, one of the things that I laughed the hardest about internally, not so much out loud, but they basically break up the documentary over, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 chapter headings. But you realize as you're going through the movie that none of the chapter headings mean anything because it's more like they were left with this, God knows how many hours, this blob of Shatner content that they then had to like find a structure to where no structure existed. And I give them points for trying, but it doesn't make any sense. The one thing this documentary did teach me, though, that I didn't have knowledge of beforehand, was William Shatner talks a lot about how much dogs mean to him. And suddenly that weird moment you and I had at a con many years ago where he just stopped the panel dead to ask a woman in the audience about her dog for like 20 minutes, suddenly that moment I had true clarity.
Right, right. building off of what you're saying, you know, earlier, though, like there was a moment in this documentary where he's trying to sum up his galaxy-brained existential thoughts, and then he chirps, "That's what I believe right now.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll be something else in 5 minutes." And I think you're right on the money when you say that if they sat him down for another interview a few days later, this movie would have been about something else entirely. Like, it's just like, it's almost as if he has like ADHD and he's just like running from like different things and hobbies or interests any given moment. And I'll say this, like I don't want to psych 101 him like too much, but I don't know if there's all that much to dig into, you know, like I and not to mean that he's shallow or anything like that, but he clearly has like a mask on. And I don't think it's ever off, you know, not only when he's in the public, but, you know, when he's on the job, too. There's a moment where he says, like, he brings it up and he's brought it up in other interviews I've heard over the years, but he's just never felt as if he's ever had any true friends. He says in this movie, like, his some of his wives have been like true friends, but that's about it. And I know there's some sort of mythology about, like, you know, Shatner and Nimoy being like really close buddies. I don't think that's true. And we've heard a lot over the years in interviews or books, you know, where Shatner said, maybe in reference to George Takei or DeForest Kelly, and he's like, "I don't know him." And I don't think he means that literally, just that he doesn't know them to their core and they don't know him to his core.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I don't think that there's that much to dig into. This is a man, like, he's lived a life, you know, but there's nothing about his career journey. There's clips from his career. We don't really understand how he made it to where he is. There's nothing about his siblings, his children, his previous marriages. There's just nothing about his life journey. This is just an excuse for him to ramble on about his thoughts about the environment or his thoughts on comedic delivery at any given moment, you know. The only thing that we did get is that a few mentions of his childhood and his parents, you know, and that he was bullied by anti-Semites growing up in Montreal, and that the kids on the sports team didn't understand why he was into theater, and then the kids in the theater didn't understand why he was into sports. And that's the most we walk away with understanding, like, his own life journey. You know, this was just a really frustratingly bad documentary to watch.
And, like, when you have this type of, like, single talking head, just the person the movie's about, you know, going on basically a monologue for 90 minutes or whatever, usually you want to get some sort of insight into them as a person. I think, like, the insight I got was more about his approach to acting and his craft. Like, when he was talking about making comedy work, I was like, okay, this guy, he's incredibly well-trained at this point in his life, but he has, like, this understanding as to how comedy works and how it doesn't work that I found interesting to hear him talk about. Like, honestly, I would rather just listen to William Shatner talk about acting for 90 minutes. I think it would actually be kind of interesting, but he doesn't really do that. But you're right. Like, he has this complete, like, mask on, and he clearly is very, he keeps his personal life quite private because, as you said, he doesn't discuss, you know, the wives or the children or grandchildren or anything like that, other than just to reference the say, you know, and say, "My children," he'll say that. But he clearly doesn't want his private life to be public. But then what are we gaining insight into? I was reminded at times, I don't know if you ever saw the documentary Becoming Bond about George Lazenby. Did you ever see that?
No.
Okay, so George Lazenby played Bond in one movie, On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
You seem shocked to hear
that. I'm not shocked. But the documentary about him is pretty much the same kind of thing. It's just him talking about his journey about through life, becoming Bond and playing Bond, and then his life afterwards. And that movie, he is somewhat similarly kind of vague about his actual life. And you get the sense, like, a lot of what he's spinning is BS. Like, he's telling a kind of a BS story about this personal journey he's gone on over the course of his life. And the movie starts to underline that and make it quite clear that George Lazenby is a bit of a car salesman and sells very much this mythology about himself. And they actually call him on it at a certain point. He just kind of like smiles and is like, well, if I believe it, it has to be true, right? And it's like, you get the sense when you walk away that yes, you've been kind of entertained and it's an amusing story, but like the documentary understands specifically who George Lazenby is and this persona and this way he hides himself. I don't get the sense of that same kind of self-awareness on the part of this movie about Shatner.
Especially when it says executive producer, William Shatner.
Yeah. I was actually shocked it wasn't directed by him. I actually expected directed by William Shatner to pop up at the end.
I think about the Spock doc, you know. And that was a warts and all look at Leonard Nimoy and his life. And you have Adam Nimoy directing it, you know, his son. And he's like, look, I'm making a documentary about my father, but he wasn't always the best father. And it was really like, it was interesting that like, oh, I kind of walked away better understanding Nimoy's life and his journey, his career, his family, like what brought him from point A to point B. I walk away from this film featuring this 93-year-old actor who, if we're playing the betting game, you know, he has limited number of years left on this earth. And if this is meant to be the definitive Bill Shatner documentary, I think it's failed utterly. You know, this is, we might just have to wait until he passes away in, you know, I mean, at his rate, I mean, this guy is still like kind of a bull. He's like, you just watch him. I was watching him on Jimmy Kimmel and he was just so incredibly cogent and spry and energized. Like, I could imagine him being around for another, like, 25, 30 years, you know. But I don't know. It was just, like, this is just utterly, like, I don't know. I've, like, laid into it enough. Like, I would just say I would not recommend watching this to anybody out there.
No, it would be very hard to recommend this one, to be honest. I mean,
I think it'd be a waste of time.
There's a couple points in this movie where you see events he's staged, you know, like a poetry reading and things like that. And I watch like the audience sitting there while he, you know, tosses out his very questionable poetic musings. And I'm like, those people, that's the audience for this movie. I don't think anyone else could even sit through this. Can you imagine a world where you showed this movie to someone who didn't go to Star Trek convention and have a sense of who William Shatner is? I think they'd be bored out of their minds.
Well, Kim, I think the only reason you and I could like stomach this is because we knew kind of the Shatner shtick, you know, like,
yeah.
Like, and, but I, that made me very worried when this movie got going. I think they called it, didn't they call it the prelude? That is the first chapter name or something like that, or maybe the prologue.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, so maybe this prologue is him just doing his shtick, and then maybe we'll get into his life a little bit later. No, it was just him spouting off his usual galaxy brain stuff that we hear at the conventions all the time. Shatner's at his best at the conventions, like, honestly, when he's trying to be funny. And
yeah,
and it's very clear from this documentary, he loves making people laugh, you know? And he's a funny guy, you know? Like, I should say he's a funny performer. And I don't know, man. Like, but when he's doing, like, when he's just talking about his existential beliefs, you and I were prepared for that because we sat through many conventions over the years, but I don't think an average audience member could possibly be prepared for what would unfold here.
No, and I do want to give, like, the documentary, like, a little bit of credit for taking a different tact, you know, having this kind of, like, philosophical exploration of its subject versus, like, here's where I was born. You know, kind of the steps along the way, kind of the almost like the Wikipedia journey, which some documentaries fall into. You know, there's the George Takei one, To Be Takei, which is, I think, more entertaining than this one, but it's pretty slight stuff. It's more just like, oh, come hang out with George Takei for 90 minutes, the end. I like that this one is trying something different, and the director who made it, Alexander O. Felipe, made a movie called 7852 about the Hitchcock shower sequence that I really liked. He's made some interesting pop culture documentaries. I just think he was defeated with this one because if you're going to make a philosophical documentary about a subject, you need someone who, when they are expounding all of this stuff, they have a beginning, middle, and end. And you and I have learned many times when Shatner goes on these tears, they very rarely have a focal point at the end.
Yeah. I don't like to be reductive like this, but give it a grade for me.
I would probably go C minus on this one.
I'd be more in like the D sort of range. Like the production values are good. The very generous licensing fees that were obviously involved here. Like I was genuinely impressed with the number of clips that they were able to gather from across his career. But it wasn't like here's some TJ Hooker clips. Let Bill Shatner talk to you about what he was feeling during this period of his career or how he ended up at this part of his career. It's mostly just like, here's a TJ Hooker clip. And then Bill Shatner saying like, yep, I was on TJ Hooker. And like, then he just starts talking about like worms in the ground and trees and how he wants to be a tree and how like he wants to be cremated and then buried underneath like a redwood sapling so that like thousands of years his atoms will be part of this redwood. And I'm just like that, but it's like, I'm not exaggerating. This is like 90 minutes of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think the most insight you get into Star Trek is him just talking about Jeffrey Hunter's version of Pike and how he was trying something different. And I was like, oh, I've never actually heard him comment on that original pilot. That's something, I guess.
I think the other interesting thing, it was only that much more helpful for me when I watched him on Jimmy Kimmel, though, is when he was talking about like his final performance as Kirk and how he did not like the take in which he dies as Kirk. You know, he says, it was fun. Pause. Oh, my. And on Jimmy Kimmel, he went into that further and he said, like, Kirk was an adventurer. And the take that he gave in Generations, it sounded as if Kirk was seeing some giant being with like a scythe and Kirk was afraid in those last split second of his life. And that's why he said, oh, my. Just in that particular inflection. But that comes from me having to watch him on Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah.
You know, not anything that I got from this documentary, you know, which is just why it's so frustrating.
Now, here's a question for you, somewhat unrelated to the film, but are you and I going to have to sit in Las Vegas this summer and hear him talk about this documentary and recite things we heard in this documentary?
The thing is, he is so ADHD that this might not even be top of mind for him by the time we get into Vegas.
Okay.
You know, Cam, if there's a screening of this documentary in Vegas, you and I are going to be skipping that particular movie night.
That would be one heck of a pool party night when they screen that by the pool.
Could you imagine just the number of people? I'm being honest, though. I mean, like, we saw the Galaxy Quest. We went to the Galaxy Quest screening last year. And it was rowdy. People were talking, blah, 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 which annoys me. Case in point, I told you all earlier, I had to go speak to the man who was on his phone during the Shatner documentary. Could you imagine the amount of talking that would go on during this documentary as people got increasingly bored?
It would be through the roof.
Yeah.
Like, I just think you'd have a small subsect of people that would hang on every word, but I think so many would just leave, or like they did with our theater.
Yeah.
Or their phones would come out or they'd start murmuring to each other. Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that note, Cam.
Yeah.
I like how we talked just as much about this terrible Shatner documentary as we did one of the most beloved episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Walter Koenig, it's your turn. It's your turn to complete the surviving TOS cast member documentary club. So
Chekhov's phaser.
Okay, so if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump onto the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod and leave reviews for us wherever you get your podcasts. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We're going to be tackling the arcs, the character arcs of these Star Trek shows that we call Star Trek. I don't know why I phrase it that way. Just call me Al Pacino at the Oscars. So.
Hoo-ah.
It'll be fun to kind of see where characters start when we first meet them and how they kind of wrap things up by the time they get to their last journey. And I think it's kind of a good way for us to kind of highlight Star Trek Discovery as it gears up for its final season. It'll be interesting to look back on like where we saw Burnham as a character in episode one versus how she's going to be going into the fifth and final season.
Yeah, we've come a long way, baby, with the Discovery cast, and I think it'll be interesting to track the progress and also just look at the history of Star Trek and see which like journeys were organic versus which ones felt really awkward.
Sure.
So I think this could be a lot of fun. And which ones just completely went nowhere. There's a few of those as well. So looking forward to that. And you can, of course, also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Varhama Candles, Smith.
I was surprised you didn't go with V as in Virginia Slims, because you said, we've come a long way, baby. that's quite the that's quite the shout out to cigarettes, Cameron.
It's like the old Flintstones cartoons. That's our sponsor this week.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORT. T is in TJ Hooker forever. ON.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
And like, yeah. Then he just starts talking about like worms in the ground and trees and how he wants to be a tree and how like he wants to be cremated and then buried underneath like a redwood sapling so that like thousands of years his atoms will be part of this redwood.